Next case is Marion Whitley and Patricia Mazzella versus Rivers Bend Health Care. Mr. Traska?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Peter Traska. I am of the Elk and Elk Law Firm, and it is my privilege. Thank you. It is my privilege to represent the estate of Ethel Christian in this action against Rivers Bend Healthcare. Before anything further, might I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal? Thank you. Quoting from this court's case, Douglas versus Daniel Brothers Coal Company in 1939. The only concern defendants have is that the action be brought in the name of the party authorized so that the defendants may not again be hailed in the court to answer for the same wrong. In this case, we find out after the complaint is filed that Ethel Christian, the ward of Marcella Christian, Ethel Christian had in fact been deceased prior to filing the complaint. We moved promptly to effect that substitution. The trial court granted the substitution on June 8th of 2005.
Counsel, is it undisputed that this is a medical claim?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is it in dispute that this is a medical claim? Are we dealing with a one-year statute of limitation?
That's right, Your Honor. No, Your Honor, there's no dispute that this is a medical claim subject to a one-year statute, right? Which, again, heightens the fact that this can be a recurring problem. To take that point a little further, there was no allegation made in this claim that this was a wrongful death claim, which would, of course, have affected a different statute. Mrs. Christian's treatment was completed at Rivers Bend in April of 2004. The claim was filed in April of 2005.
And the claim was filed in the name of?
In the name of Marcella Christian as guardian and conservator for her mother.
But in fact, she was not the guardian at that time.
That's correct. By operation of law, the guardianship would have terminated. That is a problem on the pleadings. And the issue here is whether...
Well, the issue is, did she have capacity to sue at all?
Did Marcella have capacity to sue at all?
Yes.
No, Your Honor. She would not have had capacity. Right. So, you know, Ramsey versus Neiman is a very closely analogous case where the big difference between this one and Ramsey is that no substitution had been made in Ramsey. In this case, the substitution is made. There is no objection to the substitution, either at the time the motion is made or for 9 months while the first filed case is on the docket. Your Honor's question goes to capacity. Capacity has to be pled with specificity. So in 9 months, no objection was made. The same argument that's made in 2007 in the motion that is ultimately under review here.
Was there an answer filed?
Yes, Your Honor.
What did the answer say?
The answer pled real party, and the answer pled lack of jurisdiction. Statute of limitations is not a jurisdictional argument. It's subject to waiver if it's not presented timely. And this is not a real party and interest issue. It's a nominal party issue. This court first started to say that in 1896 with the Wolf case.
But that case was voluntarily dismissed, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Wasn't there a voluntary dismissal under 41 of that case?
That's right. In this case, in the 2005 case.
What's the effect of the voluntary dismissal on all of this capacity and pleading and the rest of it? The case is gone.
Right. I would, and it would be our submission. We briefed this as a third proposition of law. Respectfully, I think that the issue is still in play very much here as a waiver issue. The case is drawn up with claims and defenses. It's 41A after all the time in the world for anybody to come in, fix what's wrong with the pleadings, assert any defenses you want to make. When the case is 41A'd, that's it. There's no going back in time to assert a defense in 2007 that should have been asserted in 2005. I mean, during that time, the estate is kept alive. There's more work done in terms of lining up experts. There's the filing fee. There's the care and feeding that a claim needs in order to survive. So there's estoppel resonances, too. But the point is that the one legitimate concern that any defendant has, the fairness concern for the defendant here, is not getting hauled in the court twice. We get that. That concern was fixed 2 years before this particular defendant even knew about the issue. It was taken care of in June of 2005. No motion is made until July of 2007 in the refile case.
So you're saying basically even though the daughter had no standing to bring the suit and when it was filed, by virtue of the fact that you corrected that by substituting the estate 2 or 3 months later? No, it was longer than 2 or 3 months later. She had been dead for 2 or 3 months by the time the suit was originally filed in the name of the guardianship, and then something happened. Were you alerted that she had been
Yes.
dead for all this time? You didn't know that when you filed your
That's correct,
complaint.
Your Honor. That's correct.
Okay. So then once you find out that the guardian that you thought was a guardian had no legal standing, you say, whoops, we better get this woman appointed as an executor and then start over and name her. So what you're doing is trying to cure what, in essence, was a nullity to begin with.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't submit that it's a nullity because the defendant at all time had notice of what the injury was, to whom the claim really belonged. The way this court has consistently characterized this issue, and again, it's not a real party issue, it's a nominal party issue. The real party is always Ethel Christian. We know what her injuries were. The defendant's placed on fair notice. Within a year of filing the complaint, 3A gives you time, a year to commence. Within the commencement period, the substitution is made. So, you know, Douglas was a case involving a similar, just an ill-advised or maybe a not advised mistake on the part of the widow. Douglas involved both a wrongful death claim and a survivorship claim. But the widow administering her husband's estate gets papers in the mail from the probate court. She believes that they appoint her. There are papers that say, fill these out to become appointed. So it's just a plain vanilla, excusable neglect mistake. Equally in Douglas, that complaint that she would file prior to becoming the administrator of the estate would be a nullity because there wouldn't be any entity. There would only be the deceased Mr. Douglas. But this court has not treated this as a nullity problem. Instead, it said it's a nominal party problem. Can it be fixed? And the fact is, in this case, that it was fixed. Let me point you further to two cases decided in 1952. One is the Kyes case, which comes right to an argument that the appellee has advanced in this case. The argument was that maybe this case is different from Douglas because in Douglas, the person who first came into court eventually became the administrator of the estate. This court in Kyes rejected that and said that the controlling fact is that the cause of action is unchanged and that the defendant is on fair notice and won't be hauled into court twice. So that's a very broadly applied rationale consistently from the time of Douglas going through Kyes, going through Canterbury, the other 1952 case.
Would we be here if you had not dismissed and refiled, if the original substitution in that case, which had gone for 9 months with no objection, had continued? Did this problem seem to arise because you refiled and now they're claiming it was a nullity from the start?
Well, no, Your Honor. I don't think the point about refiling is that this was not a timely asserted objection. We've heard the appellee try to distinguish the Douglas case on the basis that there was a better showing. I don't think that's true comparing the facts of these two cases. But even still, the fact is that this motion wasn't made, the objection wasn't made until 2 years after the suggestion and after the substitution. So if there's any infirmity in the record here, it has to be considered that the inability to bring the objection timely in the first filed action. That's really the only significance
what
of
it. If they had brought the objection in the first action, what would have happened?
You
had already substituted. What would they have objected to?
I think at the end of the day, this is a legal issue. I think if the objection is brought in the first action, it should be exactly the same outcome for the same main reason. The fact that there was a 4-day winning and a dismissal presents additional factual reasons for the appellee's weaker position in this case.
Counsel, if you were going forward on this and you never learned that the woman had died,
right,
and you're just going along as the counsel for the guardianship when there is no guardianship, and there was no substitution, and it was raised that that the woman had died, where would you be at that point?
On this record, with the particular answer filed, let's assume first an amended answer that puts capacity in play. Capacity was never put in play in either the 05 case or the 07 case here. Where would we be? You know, at some point, I would say that the cutoff is at a year because you have a year to commence. This actually is consonant with something from the appellee's brief. One of the alternative renderings of the rule here is that you have to have the proper party have commenced the action. Now, commencing is not the same thing as filing to protect the statute. Commencing happens within a year of filing. I would think that if you don't have the correct substituted party having fixed this within the first year after the complaint, I'm very pleased I don't have to make that argument.
You would lack standing.
That's right. That's right.
So no. You don't think that you lack standing from the time it was filed erroneously until the estate was brought into the action?
That's right, Your Honor. And honestly, having reviewed...
What's right? You don't think that you lack standing. In other words, you think you had standing from the date this was filed in the name of the guardianship until you correctly identified an estate.
That's correct. We did not lack standing. Ethel Christian, at all times, had standing. The question after her death is who is, and in this case because she has a guardianship, the question is who's the right party to bring her action into court. Standing goes to injury. I think that it's better to characterize this as a capacity issue. I think the cases show that...
And I don't disagree that the decedent had the injury, but she couldn't bring this action on her own because she was deceased. And then you had the daughter continuing in the role of a guardian when no guardianship existed and filing this action on behalf of the decedent who she labeled as a ward. So you're saying that the daughter still had, it was still appropriate standing at the time of the original filing, and that legitimacy continued until the estate was substituted?
So long as there was a substitution, yes. I acknowledge the problem. If the problem were not fixed, then there would be no standing. But the question is whether, does the fix relate back?
My question on the lack of capacity, are you saying that this is not jurisdictional in your view? It's not the fact that an individual has no capacity to sue legally, to even commence the suit, that you still, if you have an individual who without capacity files suit, calls the jurisdiction of the court into play?
That's not my position. That's the language of Civil Rule 9B. In order to plead capacity, there must be a specific negative averment. Now, Appellee's only response to this has been that, well, nobody knew she was dead at the time the complaint was filed. Of course, when the answer is filed, nobody knows. That doesn't explain 9 months later. I'm here saying that we get leave. We did, in fact, get leave to make the substitution, that the substitution's effective. You know, leave should be freely given as justice requires.
And, Mr. Treske, you're saying that leave was granted in the first case that was voluntarily dismissed.
I'm sorry, Justice.
Are you telling us that the leave was granted and the substitution made in first case that was voluntarily dismissed?
That's correct.
And in the second case, then, the refile case, what name was it filed in?
Oh, that was filed under the names of the co-administrators. That was filed under the names of Marion Whitley and her sister Patricia Mazzella.
In a capacity or individually?
In their capacity as administrators.
All right. And the case becomes factually confusing because there were actually two appeals to the Fourth District Court of Appeals in this case.
That's correct.
And the one that we're here on arises from the action where the final judgment was entered by the trial court, holding that a condition precedent to the subsequent action under 322117 required a showing that the estate's legal representatives could not bring the action.
That's
Isn't
correct.
Is that what we're here on?
Well, you're here on both issues, actually, Your Honor.
Didn't the Court of Appeals ultimately make a determination in this case that the legal authority to commence the suit is what we're talking about? And a guardian can't file on behalf of a person who is deceased.
Right, but
that was their holding.
That's correct. So there are two avenues that are distinct from each other for fixing the problem with the complaint. The first is that the substitution relates back, which is what we spent most of our time on. Thank you for bringing me to the second proposition of law, which is that under the Nursing Home Bill of Rights, the Act plainly says in the section, I see I'm out of time, may I finish this point?
You may finish.
The Act plainly says, the Nursing Home Bill of Rights, that any resident or guardian, and I'm paraphrasing, but the full language is in the briefs, there's no requirement of a showing, there's no requirement in the statute that certain authorized representatives have to be ruled out. The statute uses, for better or worse, you may criticize the drafting, what have you, but it is what the statute says. The plain language says that the resident or authorized representative must be unable to commence the suit.
You agree with the determination of the Fourth District Court of Appeals that the filing on behalf of the guardian was a nullity, right?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the filing was sufficient to preserve the statute of limitations. It came with a problem that needed to be fixed. The substitution of the estate properly did relate back to that filing. So in that sense,
that
no, it is not a nullity.
That was in the case that got dismissed, and the subsequent filing in the second case was properly filed, and you think it's simply a continuation of the substituted parties in the first case. Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. I have one more question. When you realized that your ward slash decedent was in fact deceased and you then substituted the estate, was that communicated to the defendant here that she had died in several months prior to the original filing?
Yes, Your Honor. And there's a little bit of back and forth on this in the briefs, but it's plain on the face of the notice of suggestion of death. Her death was noted in the suggestion as having occurred in February of 05 when the complaint was filed in April of 05. So okay. That's never been hidden.
Thank you, Mr. Kraska. Mr. Spierko?
Chief Justice Brown, may it please the Court, Mr. Traska. My name is Tim Spierko. I'm here on behalf of Rivers Bend Healthcare. And we're here today because we need to establish a rule of law that litigants, attorneys, and members of the court and the bench can follow in future cases. And it's very simple in this case. A complaint that's filed by or on behalf of a decedent by a ward who has no continuing guardianship is a nullity. That is a clear rule of law that will guide people in the future. The second rule of law is that where a personal representative of an estate has been appointed prior to the expiration of the statute of limitations, and then the complaint is still filed in the name of the deceased person, any later substitution does not relate back. And that's a fact that was not brought up by counsel, is not addressed in their brief. Ms. Mazzella and...
Help me out here, counsel. You filed an answer when? They filed this action on April 15, 2005.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the statute ran on what date?
April 25th of 2005.
The statute ran on April 25th of 2005, statute of limitations.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. And you filed an answer when?
I don't have the exact date in front of me, but it was within the time prescribed by law, so within 30.
You raised, according to your brief, plaintiff is not the real party in interest for all or part of this action, as item 11 in your answer and item 12, the court lacks jurisdiction over this matter.
Yes, and we also did raise a defense of statute of limitations.
In your answer?
Correct.
And that would comply with Civil Rule 9A?
Yes, Your Honor.
And 8C, that you have to set forth your affirmative defenses?
Correct.
Now, after that, before ruling on your defenses, the judge lets them substitute.
Correct.
Can that cure the problem for them?
A couple things. First, the answer is no. It doesn't cure the problem. Even though they're substituted, they still has to relate back to the original filing. And under the law, that doesn't happen. Another point is that that notice of suggestion of death, motion to substitute, and the order were never sent to counsel for the defendants. It was not received. We did not receive notice of that death. That's why it was not raised. And throughout the course of that first litigation...
What do you mean that's why it was not raised? What
counsel continues to say that during the 9 months the first action was pending, defendants never raised the issue. Not until it was the second filing.
But if you substitute administrators, doesn't that give you a hint that the person's died?
It does, but we never received that information, Your Honor.
You didn't get a judgment entry from the court allowing substitution?
That's correct.
So we're here on a case in which the plaintiff's lawyers go into court 2 months after the lady dies.
Correct.
Filing on behalf of a guardian who's not a guardian. They don't know their client's dead. And you represent the nursing home. And you don't know she's dead either.
That's correct.
Well, it doesn't say much about the practice of law, does it?
Well, Your Honor, we submitted discovery to them, and it was never responded during the entire
pendency. But you have a client.
Pardon?
Didn't you talk to your client?
Sure.
Didn't your client say the lady's dead?
She had moved out of our facility prior to her death by a year, over a year prior to her death.
Okay.
So she was not there. Now, what's really important here is that the administrators of the estate were appointed 2 months before the lawsuit was filed. So while plaintiffs argue that Ms. Marcella Christian didn't know the effect of filing or her mother's death or what she was doing, it's the administrators in this estate who had a fiduciary duty to pursue this action within the statute of limitations.
I'm trying to track the lines here. This is where the technicalities of the law can lead us to outcomes that might raise the eyebrow of the average citizen, but perhaps that's where we have to go here. You file an answer.
Yes.
The statute of limitations has run for the alleged medical malpractice or the medical injuries.
Correct.
But the judge hasn't ruled on anything that's in your answer.
Correct.
At that point. You didn't file a motion for summary judgment or anything else at
no,
that
Your
point.
Honor.
And so before you do something to force the judge to rule on the defenses that you have raised, they wake up and find out they don't have the right parties named, and they present something to the judge, and he grants that. So doesn't that cure it at that point? Because you've failed to get to the courthouse first and get a ruling on your properly raised defenses.
It does
so
not.
So they beat you there.
It does not for several reasons. First, the first case is a nullity. So the court didn't even have subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, if it's a nullity, why do we have Rule 9A, capacity?
She didn't have capacity. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, it says it's not necessary to aver the capacity of a party to sue or to be sued. And it says when a party desires to raise an issue of legal existence of any party or the capacity of any party to sue or be sued, the authority of a party to sue or be sued in a representative capacity shall do so by specific negative averment.
Right.
So that rule would seem to fit in. I mean, these cases we're talking about are old cases that predate the civil rules that are in place, and the civil rules are notice pleadings. So your client is on notice that somebody, maybe not the right person or the not properly named person, is complaining that there's a cause of action.
Correct.
And isn't that enough under the modern rules? And do the old cases even have any application to the
I would submit that it's not enough under the rules, because even in these cases, when you deal with medical claims, a plaintiff can submit a 180-day letter that extends the statute 180 days. Certainly at that time, the defendant is on notice of a potential claim. Okay, and then if they don't file within 180 days, they have missed the statute of limitations. Same scenario here. Even though defendant has notice of a potential claim, they don't have the proper parties. They submitted discovery without responses because this person's dead. Person who filed suit has no capacity. And more importantly, the people with the capacity, with the standing, with the authority and duty to file this suit took no action. They could have obtained separate counsel. They could have talked to their sister and said, are you doing anything as the ward that we need to follow up on? They could have looked into anything, but they did nothing.
Mr. Spirito, let me get you away from the trial strategy of counsel, and let's get to a legal question that maybe you can help me resolve.
Yes, sir.
The first question I have is, since the initial complaint was filed in the name of a guardian, and you claim that's a nullity because a guardian cannot sue on behalf of a deceased, can a party substitute in a case that's a nullity?
No.
Is there any authority that says that cannot be done that you can give me?
I don't believe there's any specific authority that says that, but if a case is a nullity, it does not exist. You can't substitute into something that does not exist.
And then my next question is, all of the nullity that you're telling me about was voluntarily dismissed pursuant to Civil Rule 41. Am I right about that?
Correct.
So regardless of whether it was a nullity or there was a substitution or it was proper, it's gone away.
Right.
And then there was a subsequent case filed.
Correct.
And in what name was the subsequent case presented?
By the co-administrators on behalf of the estate.
So that would have been a properly designated plaintiff in that instance.
It would have been properly designated as a plaintiff. However, it's clearly beyond the statute.
The question I have is, it's beyond the statute of limitations, is your point, and you submitted a summary judgment motion to the court on that.
Correct.
Does that relate back to the earlier authorized amendment by the trial court? Why or why not?
And the answer to that is no, because under this tolling statute, or the saving statute, I'm sorry, it's in order to relate back and to be timely, the prior action must have been properly commenced.
Okay. And what authority can you give me to that I can rely on to verify what you're suggesting?
That's the wording of the statute. It says the prior action must be properly commenced.
And your view is because it wasn't properly commenced, there can be no relation back of the subsequent lawsuit.
Correct, Your Honor.
And counsel, since we're talking semantics, the words lack of standing, which was raised in your initial answer, correct?
Correct.
And the issue of lack of capacity, could you give me your position on whether those are the same or significantly different?
In my estimation, Your Honor, capacity is you're authorized to take the action. They're so very close, but you're authorized to take the action. You're mentally competent to take the action. You have the authority to act for a corporation, authority to act for a ward, maybe, things of that nature. Standing means you don't have, back to my law school definition, I'm sorry. You don't have the ability to take that argument. And in this case, the people who have the ability to take that argument forward are the estate representatives.
But the question is, because the issues of what you raised in your answer were standing and jurisdiction.
Correct.
And we've been talking about lack of capacity to sue. So, I'm trying to find out if all of these things are interrelated, and you put the other side on notice of the problem as well.
I don't know that this is a capacity issue.
You would say it is not a capacity issue.
Right. It's a subject matter jurisdiction. They had no authority to file that suit. It doesn't exist. So it's something that just can't be done.
Mr. Spurko.
Yes.
Your arguments are primarily based on the civil rules. The civil rules seem to suggest that substitution be fairly freely permitted.
Correct.
And we've also got a Civil Rule 1B that expressly requires the rules to be construed and applied to affect just results.
Correct.
That provision has been discussed throughout the history of the rules, including a case from 73, Peterson versus Teodosio, which is often cited about doing justice. Is the position that you're advocating consistent with that directive in Civil Rule 1B?
I think it is, Your Honor. The bottom line, and plaintiff raised the issue of not being hailed into court twice. It didn't happen in this case, but it certainly could have. There was nothing in this case, since counsel didn't know that Ms. Christian was deceased, there was nothing to stop the administrators from obtaining separate counsel, and we would have two causes of action filed in this case. That does not further the interest of justice. What would further the interest of justice is a bright-line rule saying if somebody's deceased and you file suit on their behalf and then later you try to substitute a previously appointed state representative, that should not be permitted. That furthers the interest of justice for both parties. Plaintiff could have taken many steps to avoid this. Okay, they didn't have to wait until the last minute to file suit. Quite frankly, they had 10 days to cure the problem after suit was filed by contacting their client. They knew they had an 85-year-old client, and they could have said, is she still alive? Are you still the guardian? Before we file this suit, we want to make sure you're still the guardian. then there's no evidence that they took that action. And more importantly, as I stated earlier, there's no evidence that the estate representatives did anything.
Counsel, I've gone back and forth on this as I read it, and the more I hear your arguments, both sides seem to be in a relatively unsympathetic position to me. You say you raise lack of standing in your answer, not lack of capacity. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what did you mean by that? What did that statement mean to you when you pled it?
Your Honor, at that time we were preserving the defense of lack of standing based upon what we would then do in further discovery as to whether or not the
So it was a shotgun. You didn't know anything in particular at that point?
Nothing particular, no.
You didn't know she was dead?
Correct.
So if you had known she was dead, what would your appropriate pleading have been?
At that point, probably would have filed a motion to dismiss.
Would it have been lack of capacity rather than lack of standing?
I think I would have pursued it under a lack of both, possibly, Your Honor. But
well, which would it be, now that you've had a chance to think about this?
I don't know the answer to that question.
That's what we're here about.
That's not our position. Our position is that the case didn't exist because she didn't have the authority to file it. And there was no subject matter jurisdiction by the court to relate that back once the estate representatives were apparently substituted.
Thank you, Mr. Spirko.
Thank you.
Mr. Traska, you may have 1 minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I have just 2 points to cover. I was surprised to hear the appellee assert that Rivers Bend never received the notice of suggestion of death, the motion to substitute, or the court's order substituting. We've had this case in appeals for several years. Lots of things have gone back and forth. I was not aware that anything was not actually being received. And it's surprising to me also that the court order might not have been received. That wasn't addressed, I don't believe, in appellee's brief or at any point prior to today. So I don't think that that really should enter into this court's consideration. Secondly, on this notion, I believe as Justice Stratton asked point blank, is the filing of that first complaint a nullity? If that were the law of Ohio, then you wouldn't have Douglas, you wouldn't have Canterbury, you wouldn't have Keyes, you wouldn't have the Rust case from just a couple of months ago, that disciplinary case. That has never been the law of Ohio. I think that Justice Pfeiffer's comment that even prior to the civil rules, even prior to Peterson versus Teodosio and Civil Rule 1B, the courts of Ohio had figured out that you don't mete out this drastic consequence for a technical error that can be fixed, and that in this case actually is fixed with no action taken against it for 2 years. The Douglas court hit it right on the head, and it's a broad rationale that is applied in lots of different circumstances. The only concern defendant has is not being dragged into court twice. We eliminated that concern by making the substitution.
Counsel,
that's the reason why it relates
to why don't you take a swing at Justice Lanzinger's question? What's the difference between standing and capacity?
I spent about a day and a half reading on that. I'm not sure that that the cases speak with one voice to that question. That's a very confusing question. To go back to the law school horn books, standing is injury in fact. Capacity is your ability to actually bring the action. Injury, in fact, belongs to the person who has the injury. To draw a parallel, bankruptcy cases, if a plaintiff comes into court already having declared bankruptcy, the claim is an asset of the bankruptcy trustee. So there's a lot of overlap between these issues, but that's an issue where plaintiff doesn't have standing, as all the cases say, because the claim belongs physically to somebody else. The trustee is the only one who can act on those claims. Nevertheless, you can still have a substitution in that circumstance where there's no standing.
What about capacity? And the question of capacity and standing as it relates to jurisdiction of the court.
Right. Well, the question here is whether it relates back. If the fix relates back, then...
But the relation back implies that there was an action that was filed. And if there's no jurisdiction, or if it's a nullity to begin with, was it properly filed? Is there anything to relate back to?
And yes, there is. The Hornbook definition of standing that I remember is injury in fact. Injury in fact in this case belongs to Ethel Christian. At that point, you have a capacity issue. Is it the right nominal party, which is the additional label that this court has always used, starting in Wolf and in Douglas and in lots of these other subsequent cases. It's not necessarily a capacity issue or a standing issue. It's a nominal party issue. The name's wrong. Can it be fixed? That's what it comes down to. I would agree fully that the cases are not very clear on that, but I don't think the case should turn on a technicality like that that really only a lawyer can love. That's not what the Douglas court prescribed.
Thank you, Mr. Traska.
Thank you, Governor.
Counsel are now dismissed.